From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack, and I've been working 9 to 5 on my own for the last 2 weeks because Evan Dawson was in Spain with the WXXI Travel Club. So Dolly Parton and I are running everything here on the talk show. All jokes aside, it was another busy week on the program, and we heard from many of you about a range of topics, from the Olympics to the relationship between climate change and architecture, to if more parents decide to homeschool their kids out of concerns about school safety. You can hear those episodes and more on our website, wxxinews.org/connections. But we'll start this week's podcast with some of the most emotional moments from the week. The March for Our Lives was held last weekend in Washington, D.C., with more than 800 similar demonstrations popping up around the world, including one here in Rochester. Participants were marching to demand gun control legislation following the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. We were joined on the panel by two people who attended the rally in Rochester. Bob Good is a longtime activist who participated in the event, and he was also a participant in a draft board raid during the Vietnam War. You'll hear from him, but first, you'll hear Lentori Johnson. She's the mother of Johnny J.R. Johnson, who was killed in the shooting outside the Boys and Girls Club in Rochester in 2015. In this clip, she discusses how losing J.R. led her to a life of activism.
From the moment almost I lost J.R., I had to find a way to channel the hurt, the rage, the sorrow that I felt in my child being taken the way he was. Yeah, to me, it made no sense. Not only did he lose his life, but that the method, the weapon that was utilized on the night of those murders could even be in any individual hand. To me, that was just mind-boggling in itself. And I'm gonna tell you, it was a process. It was a process for me, because first I had to absorb the fact that I'd lost him. Then I had to plan, and I thank God for youth, because it was the youngest individuals of my family. Had it not been for them, I really don't know how I would have got through it, because they were all hands on preparing for his funeral. And so whatsoever I wanted, they were instrumental in helping me to make sure it would happen. And it's like I share with the audience, anyone who attended JR's funeral, there was a mandate, and I know God gave it, because on every pallbearer shirt that was at their funeral, they wore this message, and it was, commit, take back our neighborhoods, organize, do something was in essence the message that went forward. And I was so uplifted Saturday. I mean, really, between watching the youth on TV to arriving at Washington Square to see the children, the young people who participated that day, it was an affirmation for me that change will come. Change will come. And I'm not like most adults. I believe it's going to be sooner than most people will want to believe. I do believe that. I really believe that.
What do you think JR would be thinking if he were here, watching you participate in this activism and spreading this message that's so important to you?
You know, for people who knew JR, you know, when I tell people this, and it's all I can say to you about JR, I hope he would be proud of me. When I talk to him, and I still do, I hope I make him proud. And I asked a few things of the Lord in my prayers. And one of the things I asked for was the heart of my child, because JR was fierce. He really was. Strong opinion. able to stand up for itself. Sometimes, like parents do, I try to pull him back, but he was always that way. I think God granted me that. You know, I tell people, I'm like anybody, I'm human. Sometimes I'm afraid, but I don't live in fear. There's no fear in me. You know, afraid is a thing we all deal with sometimes. But I really believe that that's the Lord giving me my wish to let me be a channel for my child.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your beautiful speech over the weekend. Thank you all for being here, because when we talk about demonstrations and protests, I think there's often a tendency to focus on numbers. How many people showed up? How many people were marching? But that doesn't necessarily translate to success. But I think one of the things that may further causes is the passion and the hope behind them, like what you've just discussed, Lentori. And Bob, over the past few decades, as you've participated in many marches and many demonstrations, you have your own personal story when you became an activist during Vietnam. And I know your mother was actively involved in that too. Can you speak to the heart of being an activist and why you think that might make a difference?
The passion, I think, is one of the very important pieces. In my particular case, my brother was drafted out of high school, and 6 weeks after he was sent to Vietnam, he was killed in action. And it was obviously a very devastating time for all of us in the family, and obviously and particularly my parents, but all of us, of course. And a few years later, I had an opportunity to participate in a draft board action in Camden, New Jersey. And we were arrested, and during the trial, my mother came to speak and had just an amazingly powerful testimony about, you know, her two sons, one of whom was killed in the war and the other was on trial. And I think one of the things when I was listening here to Hannah and talking about JR and realizing the passion that's here now, that one of the parallels is that it's so close to home, that one of the things that I find difficult at times to explain to people about Vietnam who weren't there or maybe of a different generation and weren't, you know, growing up at that time, was that the fact of the draft made it a personal issue for everybody. You had to do something. You had to respond in some way. Whether it was go in, whether it was evade, whether it was get a deferment, whether it was protest, but it was personal. And that had an effect on our society as a whole. And what I see happening now with these young people and hearing them talk about being the mass shooting generation and knowing that kids today go to school, like you said, Hannah, where would I hide? What would I do? We go through lockdown drills. That's a new reality. And what the current generation is experiencing touches them right to the core. And it is what I think inspires the passion that we saw over this weekend and will, I believe, continue to see. And I think it will make a difference.
Next, a new play at Jiva Theater is receiving rave reviews for addressing the subjects of war, challenges faced by refugees, and propaganda. The show is called Heartland, and it's about an Afghan refugee who comes to America to take care of his American girlfriend's father after she dies in an attack in Afghanistan. In this clip, you'll hear Jiva's executive director, Chris Minnelli, and local actor Jonathan Niketha. They discuss the play and the importance of telling human stories, especially stories that reflect different cultural experiences.
These are human stories, and we need to tell these stories. And we need to also, you know, we have a responsibility as a theater to do the work to make sure they're portrayed authentically. That's really key. You know, Gabe does not share a cultural heritage with a lot of the characters that he's telling a story about. So the thing that's remarkable about him as a playwright is he's really gone that extra mile to work with consultants, to have other people that he's brought in, to work really closely with our director of the show, Perun Yousafzada, to make sure that we're being truthful to the culture that we're trying to portray on stage. And just a small story that, you know, in our photo call for the show, which happens before, you know, we've opened the production, we did all the photos. And when we got them back, we had learned the day after that the headscarf that we were using was actually not culturally appropriate. Mm-hmm. So we actually made the costume change and we actually redid all the photos for the show because we want to make sure we're representing the community in an appropriate way. We're always learning and we have to be open to always learning as well.
Chris, you brought up a point that I think is something that we can have all of our guests address. When we talk about diversity and inclusion and including different voices in art, this project is a great example. It's a poignant script. But Gabriel Jason Dean is a white man. He's writing about a culture that is not his own. It reminds me of what happened last year in the art world. There was a white artist, Dana Schutz. She painted a piece of work based on photos of Emmett Till, the teenager who was lynched by white men in Mississippi in 1955. There was outrage. There were protests. People said this work doesn't deserve to be created because this is not her story. What would you say to people who would say, Gabriel Jason Dean is a white man, should he be writing about an Afghan experience?
Yeah, and I think that is the great piece of Gabe's work because he tries to be as true as he can with his own experience. And when he doesn't have that experience, he goes to others to make sure he can be as authentic as he possibly can be. That's really important. You have to be inclusive. You have to get other people to help you if you're going to try to tell stories from other points of view.
The danger of appropriating is something that we talk about on this program. Annette and Jonathan, I'm sure you deal with that in theater all the time when either you're reading scripts or you're watching shows. What do you think?
In particular, to go to the comment about Emmett Till in that illustration, Emmett Till's mother made the decision to have an open casket. And the photographs that were there were meant as she did not want her son to die for anything. She wanted to truly and authentically show exactly what her son went through and the way she found her son. And so that image that's seared into everyone's mind who saw it then, who, like myself, who was born after the incident, grew up seeing, it's important to honor sort of the ultimate storyteller in that. And I think that's Emmett Till's mother. So to take something that's iconic and sort of change it and shift it, that's not the story to begin with. As we talked about with the playwright for Heartland, there's a story. There's an acknowledgement of his story that opened something up and the way he went about doing, not just getting the blessing, but also getting it right. That's how you tell a story. And you tell a story that invites other people to correct you, that invites other people to inform you so that the way that we only have our own lens. I mean, as artists, we only have our own lens. But if we can appropriately get insight into how to portray other people authentically through the stories that we wish to tell, that's a deeper conversation that doesn't often happen, but it obviously happened with Heartland.
We'll end this week's podcast with some terminology. We've talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect on the talk show before. If you missed that episode, the Dunning-Kruger effect is a cognitive bias where people of low ability or low knowledge of a subject think they know more than they do. But this week on the show, we learned about another term, the Semmelweis effect. It refers to the reflex-like tendency to reject evidence because it contradicts some established norms or beliefs. This came to our attention thanks to the PBS Digital Studio show, The Origin of Everything, hosted by Yale doctoral student Danielle Bainbridge. In this clip, you'll hear her discuss the origin of why we wash our hands after we go to the bathroom and how that eventually led to the term the Semmelweis reflex.
The story was kind of outrageous. So the first physician, he was a Hungarian physician whose last name was Semmelweis, he saw that women were dying of these illnesses when they were in childbirth. And there was an assumption at that point that it had something to do explicitly with childbirth, that that's what was killing these women. But one of the physicians in his hospital who performed an autopsy on one of these women's bodies also contracted the illness and died. So his theory, Semmelweis, was that small pieces of corpse were being passed from physician to patient, and it was killing both of them. And so he thought that this was somehow being integrated into the skin through small pieces of dead skin. So even though that wasn't necessarily it, it was actually bacteria and also viruses that were transmitting these diseases, but he didn't know what that was at the time. He was actually more spot on than he could have ever imagined because he started having interns in the hospital wash all of their instruments and their hands in these like really strong antibacterial solutions that they were basically scouring everything after every procedure. And the death rate of women and physicians from these illnesses completely dropped off. But the problem was that the other physicians thought that his crazy theories made it look like they were passing diseases or that they were unclean and killing women. So they basically ostracized him. He lost his license. He couldn't perform medicine anymore. He lost his position at the hospital. And eventually, he was sending these letters, these open public letters, you know, kind of a la Martin Luther, and sending them to different physicians about how they were killing their patients. And he was committed to an insane asylum because they thought that he was a troublemaker, that he was out of his mind. But ultimately, and he died in the insane asylum, but ultimately, we found out years later that he was correct. And so the Semmelweis reflex is when you believe, because an idea is outside of the current cultural norms, that it's incorrect. So that you refuse concrete evidence just because the common mainstream idea doesn't align with what you think it should. And I thought, wow, that's a really haunting legacy, especially because part of the idea was that later scientists who came after him who had similar theories about hygiene and heating things up and virus control and germ control were then sort of lauded as geniuses, and he died in obscurity. And when I was looking at his name, I thought, oh, well, you know, Louis Pasteur, like his name lives on in pasteurization. And this poor physician from Hungary, his name lives on in an idea of rejecting evidence. So it was kind of a weird turnaround at the end of the episode when we realized that. But it also was, I think it was kind of an amazing takeaway, because I left that question open to the audience and people started writing in examples of the Semmelweis reflex, which is, you know, when you reject this evidence. And they had all sorts of different historical examples from science and from medicine, from historical claims. One wrote in a story from archaeology. So it was kind of interesting to see that this is a relatively common phenomenon, that's sometimes more comfortable to go with the majority than it is to accept a new idea, even in the face of evidence.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack, and she's Dolly Parton. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.